Hello and welcome to the HOA Show, where we discuss the news, problems, trends, and critical issues relating to life in a homeowner association. Join us every episode, and together we'll explore how to survive and thrive in the dizzying world of HOAs.
Hello, and welcome to the HOA Show. In this episode, we'll be discussing SB 326, commonly referred to as the Balcony Bill. I'm your host, Ryan Gazelle, and today we're joined by attorney Chuck Fenton, as well as Tim Klein. Chuck Fenton is a managing partner of the law firm Fenton, Grant, Mayfield, Kaneda, and Litt. Their firm is specialized in construction defect law for common interest developments throughout the Southwest. He's an active member and regular instructor for both CAI and CACM. And if your bio line is to be believed, before becoming an attorney, you were a commercial insurance broker. Is that right, Chuck?
Right. Fortunately or unfortunately, I was a commercial insurance broker for Rollins Hootie Hall, which eventually became Aon. And with that, I also worked construction for all summers during college and high school. So I have a little construction experience and some insurance experience, which is, I think, why I ended up in construction defect litigation.
Wow. All right. So I've got my future mapped out for me here. And Tim, it's not too late for you.
Yeah, look for future in law.
Tim Klein is the CEO of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, which he founded in 1998. He's been specializing in common interest development since the mid-80s and was one of the first people in the country to earn the prestigious CIRMS designation. All right, I'm so glad to have both of you here to weigh in on this crazy important topic. Chuck, I know this bill has the whole industry pretty much scared out of their minds. There's a lot to unpack, so I think we'll kind of take it in three steps. First, how did this bill come about? Second, what does it mean for associations as far as the requirements? And third, what are your recommendations to boards on how to best comply? So diving right in, how the heck did this bill come about?
Well, right. I appreciate you guys having me. And I will say it came about, unfortunately. There was a tragedy in June of 2015 where there was a deck collapse in Berkeley, California, where six college students, I believe, died from the deck collapse, as well as seven others were seriously injured. My understanding, they were having a good time on this deck when it just collapsed. And later they found out it was due to lack of maintenance and dry rot. And this building was only 8 years old.
And that was an apartment building, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And so this law became effect not only for apartments, but condominium associations as well.
And unfortunately, we were unable to get it removed from the condo association requirements, right?
Right. And, you know, that's the source of contention with a lot of people. Some people think, well, this was a typical overreaction by our legislature. And others believe that this was a necessary step by our legislature. And I think the listeners will be able to decide once we're finished talking about this today if it's overburdensome and it was really a step that needed to be taken. Because as you know, there's plenty of laws on the books that could take care of what actually happened, meaning negligence, breach of failure to maintain and issues such as that, which there's claims that the people that were injured and the families of the deceased could make against the apartment owner. But adding all these extra steps, some people think it's too much.
Chuck, we refer to it as the balcony bill, but it's really, decks, walkways, stairways, anything that's above the ground.
You know, that's true. And I think that gets us into Ryan's second question, meaning what are the requirements going to be? And Tim, you're exactly right. So when you talk about what is to be inspected, it's really exterior elevated elements. So not only decks and balconies, but you're talking about all load-bearing components beyond the exterior walls of the building. You're talking about not only decks and balconies, but stairways, walkways, and the railings. And it has to be constructed primarily out of wood. Steel decks aren't applicable to this piece of legislation.
And the reason it's important for in a condominium association is the deck itself is usually a common area. I mean, right, it's the maintenance responsibility of the association, even though that deck may service an individual unit.
It is. Most of these decks are common area. And if they're not, they're exclusive use common area that usually the association takes the responsibility on. Now, that's an interesting question of what's going to happen now. I think documents may be written differently now where they make the individual responsible for these decks. We've seen that in many other components in these condominium projects over the past decade where developers now are sometimes making the roofs above the units the responsibility of the owners, as well as plumbing within the walls, which we never saw, you know, 15 years ago.
So if developers going forward in an attempt to skirt this requirement would require the individual owners to be responsible for maintaining, repairing, and replacing those balconies, wouldn't that mean that every single owner would have to pay to have this inspection done, as opposed to the association, you know, pooling their resources?
That is correct.
Well, I guess that we need to jump into what the exact requirements are. What are they? How many years?
So starting in January 2025, these deck inspections need to be completed. So that's the first requirement. The second is it needs to be completed by a licensed architect or structural engineer according to a randomized list of components. What's interesting about that is, so you're not only talking about licensed architects or structural engineers now, you're also having to bring a statistician in to design the testing. So now that statistician is involved, which is an extra cost to this entire process. And once the inspections occurred, the structural engineer who's going to have to stamp this plan, or architect who's going to have to stamp this report, has to have a 95% confidence level that the results for the entire project, that there's confidence that they inspected all of them, so that they could prove that these deficiencies either are there or aren't there. And what's interesting about that is usually in our construction defect case, we don't even need to get to the 95% level. We've been using statisticians for years, which, as I mentioned before, are very expensive, but usually courts are only requiring us to get to about the 90% level. So this is even more stringent than that.
So basically, if you've got 100 unit condominium association, 100 balconies, they're going to want to inspect all 100.
Well, they're going to want to basically invasively test 15%, approximately 15% when you're talking about 100, and then visually inspect probably another 30 to 40. The statistician will design that testing, but they usually won't go out and visually inspect and obviously won't invasively test all these decks. Where the expense comes is in the invasive testing portion of this, where they have to tear up the membrane. They have to look at the structural integrity of whether it's a walkway, whether it's a deck, whether it's a balcony. They have to look at these issues and then extrapolate from there. If they look at 15% of the decks and they find dry rot or structural issues in every one of them, then it's going to be 100% of them need to be repaired. And if it's 7% of the 15, the statistician will work out that percentage. So they won't really ever visually inspect about 100%, and they won't invasively test probably more than 15% of whatever the amount of decks they're looking at.
And this is not something that can be done with some sort of a you know, camera, a specialized camera that can kind of see through walls, like a leak detection situation.
So I'm not saying that's not possible, but what I will say is most structural engineers and architects will require some sort of invasive testing to make sure, because there's technologies out there which will help in this. And that is going to be left to that structural engineer or architect to make that decision. It does not say they have to do invasive testing, but I will tell you from the structural engineers that I'm dealing with and the architects, that if they're going to put the stamp on it and they're going to be responsible for it, they're going to make darn sure that they've done everything they can.
It's their butts on the line, right?
That's right. That's right.
Chuck, I was curious, you know, in sometimes when we have these really difficult, complex pieces of legislation come down, the legislature will say this only applies to projects that are 30 units or larger. I didn't see anything in the bill that would say that even a two-unit association that has balconies might be obligated to comply with that. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, except for the fact it does say it. It says three units. It should be 30 units. I would agree with your initial assessment that usually you see something with larger units, but it's three units and it's any element above 6 feet.
So any association with three or more units in the association, not in a building?
Correct.
Interesting. And how often do they have to go through this process?
That's a part of the requirements we're talking about, and I really appreciate you bringing us back to that, because I tend to, you know, float off into the air once in a while. But so it's every 9 years after the initial inspection, and what they're doing is they're trying to follow the reserve study.
every 9 years, and it starts in 2025.
2025.
I was just going to say, which is, as the day that we're recording this podcast, is 1,605 days from today. It just seemed like a long ways off, but that will go by very quickly.
Chuck, you brought up the reserve study. You said that every 9 years to try to go in line with the reserve study. What do you mean by that?
As you know, the associations are required to have their reserve studies. I believe it's every 3 years or so to fall in line with when they would have to do their reserve study. Tim also brought up a very good point there. Although it seems like a long way off, it's really not. And what associations need to be doing right now is they need to be setting a reserve line and starting to put monies into this reserve item for this inspection, because this inspection is not going to be cheap. You know, for a 100-unit inspection, it could be something like $2,500 to $5,000 per deck or per walkway that they have to inspect. So this can get very expensive.
Wow.
You know, 100-unit project, they could be talking about $75,000 for this inspection.
That's due in 4 short years.
Correct. Now, I do think that by then they'll have a better take on how to do these inspections. But the structural engineers and architects that I've been talking to right now are looking at that amount of money to do these inspections.
And there's obviously going to be a mad rush as we approach 2025. So have you met any associations or discussed with anybody that's already started this process?
I have, and I will tell you that one of the benefits, if there is ever a benefit of going through a construction defect claim, is I know myself and others in the industry that are handling construction defect claims are offering to fulfill this inspection, because we're out there doing destructive testing anyway. So some of them are going forward as part of their construction defect claim and doing these inspections. But if you're an older association, that's not going to happen if you're over 10 years. So you're basically going to have to really look into your reserves. And I don't think many or any of them are actually doing the deck inspections yet.
And given the expense, I'd imagine that many associations will need that full 4 years or so to save up the money to do this.
They will. And if there's one thing that the corporate counsel lawyers and other, and obviously their community managers can do, is start advising their boards of that. I think it's extremely necessary that they do that.
Chuck, I was curious. There is a provision in the law, as I understand it, that restricts or prohibits provision in a CC&R that would preclude the board from taking on a construction defect claim against the developer. But it doesn't have any impact on the statute of limitations. Is that right?
Under SB 326, it has two parts to the legislation. One is the balcony bill, and the other is whether membership has to take a vote for a construction defect claim. Obviously, those are two separate issues. So, but under SB 326, we were able to change the law to where there's no vote requirement any longer to move forward with a construction defect claim. The members don't have to vote on it. It's a board decision.
Interesting. Well, that's good for you.
Yes, it's actually good for the community as well. It's obviously my opinion that those provisions were put in there to try to stand in the way of an association in moving forward with a claim for construction defects. Because as you know, unfortunately, we have tremendous apathy in communities with voting most of the time.
Yes. And the statute of limitations is, what, 10 years for construction defect?
It is. And what's interesting with construction defects, that your outside time to make a claim is 10 years from substantial completion or notice of completion. But SB 800, which was passed in 2003, came out with some interesting warranty provisions now. In the old days, when you know we all met and were practicing insurance and law, it used to be 3 years from the time you knew of your defect, you had to make your claim. That's oversimplified, but that's simply what it was. Now, there are warranty periods which run from 1 year all the way to 10 years. So example, 1 year would be noise intrusion, 2 years would be dryer ducts, then you'd have 4 years for plumbing components that aren't working properly, so on and so forth. And then the larger ones, you know, your structural, your roof, your stucco are under the 10-year provisions. So, but that's how the legislation is set forward now.
So the balconies would fall into that 10-year slot.
They would fall into that 10-year, yes. And all the structural components.
So what are you recommending to boards on how best to move forward with compliance?
Well, what I'm recommending is just what we talked about before. Let's start saving for reserves within the next few years. Let's create a plan. And I'm saying, you know, within a year, let's start creating a plan on who we're going to talk to and get bids for these structural engineers or architects. I've already seen pop up a few of these deck inspection companies. Let's, you know, bring them in, talk to them, see what they can do, see if there's financing available, things like that. Really look into this. Don't wait till the last minute is really my recommendation.
And is there a penalty for non-compliance by January 2025?
There will be a penalty. I don't know exactly what that penalty is, but I know it's a financial penalty.
This has been very illuminating. I'm scared to death and I don't even own a condo.
Yeah, I don't either. It's going to be very difficult for everybody to go through for sure.
Tim, do you have any thoughts on this?
You know, Chuck, one of the things that I find curious is how does a reserve study preparer reasonably know how much money to set aside for this constructive testing that's going to be required by the new law? And secondly, can they reserve for legal fees for expected litigation and discovery costs? I thought a reserve study was really designed to set aside money for needed renovation and remodeling due to failing components, but have you ever seen them reserved for the money necessary to pursue that?
Well, what's interesting, no, they don't reserve for litigation, but yes, you know, the reserve studies are never really for repairs. They're for maintaining the association. And this would just be a reserve amount for a maintenance item of investigation. So it's not so much litigation, it's more so for maintaining these components is the way the reserve analysts are going to look at this.
And so for communities that maybe were built 2015 and sooner, they'd want to look into this as soon as possible before that 2025 or that 10-year time frame elapses, right?
Absolutely. They're really going to want to start reserving and start bringing in these deck inspection companies or a structural engineer architect that they know to design a plan on how to go about this, because you're not going to want to do this last minute, as we mentioned, and you're also not going to want to, you know, jump right into it without investigating which structural engineer, deck inspection company, or architect you're going to use.
I guess my point was just that, you know, if you've got to have this done anyway, you'd want to do it sooner than later if you're on that bubble of the 10-year mark, so that if you do need repair work done, then you can go after the developer.
Correct. Absolutely. If you're under the 10-year mark, this is an inspection that you can talk to a lawyer about. And we have structural engineers, obviously, and architects we work with on a daily basis, and we can help facilitate those inspections.
Tim, a question for you. Do you think that most personal lines loss assessment policies might provide coverage in this circumstance?
You know, I'm concerned about that. And the reason I am concerned about that, Ryan, is most loss assessment policies follow the perils provided by the underlying policy, the HO6 in this case. And so most HO6s have latent building defect, poor materials, workmanship, those type of exclusions. So it really depends on the adjuster. My advice would be for an individual homeowner who is special assessed for this type of circumstances, definitely to submit it to their agent or broker and have a claim tendered. But I'm not really very optimistic in terms of coverage. You know, Chuck, one of the things I had a question about from an insurance perspective, one of the things I'm anticipating in terms of litigation, is as we get closer to that January 1, 2025 date, owners who are trying to sell their units are going to have an obligation to disclose, I think, the status of this destructive testing. And
that's a great point.
And I'm really concerned about the board getting sued for a restriction of trade or a similar lawsuit because they aren't able to sell their unit because the board hasn't complied with this new law.
Sure. And I don't think the individual unit owner selling their unit will have that issue. Obviously, anybody can sue anybody in this country for anything. But I will say that it's going to be the association's responsibility unless developer starts changing their documents, as we mentioned before. But it's going to be the association's responsibility to start reserving now. And, I don't think an individual member will know if the association is setting aside reserves for this unless their reserves go up because of this. So that is certainly something that should be discussed.
My concern, Chuck, is that what owner is rightfully going to want to put 20% down and buy into a condominium association only to turn around and be immediately special assessed for the cost to pursue something that should have been done by this due date?
I agree. And by the way, the association, if they do discuss a special assessment before somebody purchases that unit, that certainly should be disclosed. You are correct. And I hope that associations don't go to that method and wait till the last minute and do that. But we know that some probably will. But let's hope they don't.
Well, it's most likely going to be the smaller associations that don't have a professional manager and are completely unaware of this new bill.
Agreed.
Any other thoughts to add, Chuck or Tim?
You know, a little bit of what happens once the inspections are completed. The retained structural engineer or architect, their report has to contain a few things. One, it has to identify the building components comprising the load-bearing components associated with the waterproofing systems. It has to explain the current physical conditions of the load-bearing components and the waterproofing systems, including whether the condition presents an immediate threat to the health and safety of the residents. It also has to explain the expected future performance and the remaining useful life of the load-bearing components and the waterproofing systems, and recommendations for any necessary repairs or replacement of the load-bearing components and associated waterproofing systems. I think I mentioned before as well that once the inspector stamps a report and gives it to the association, they also, if there is an emergency repair that needs to take place, they need to immediately get that to the building department. If there are other necessary repairs, they have a reasonable time to get it to the building department, but they also have to stay sent to the association and the building department. So both of them.
Interesting. And Tim, what do you think if a balcony was found to be an immediate danger, posing an immediate danger, it's not safe, and the unit gets red tagged? Do you see the HO6 carriers paying for that relocation or cost of living in a hotel and dining out while they're unable to live there?
That's a great question, Ryan. Like the loss assessment coverage, the loss of use, or if it's absentee owner, loss of rents coverage, is tied to the perils being provided by the HO6. So if the HO6 excludes this construction defect, latent building defects, poor materials, poor workmanship, then I would anticipate they would not cover the relocation, which could take months, I think, by the time they pull permits and get bids.
And similarly, Chuck, you wouldn't think that the association would be responsible for paying for that owner to live somewhere else, right?
No, I would not. But I will tell you, the owners will be expecting likely their insurance coverage either through the association or through their own carrier for their separate interest to take care of it. So, Tim, yeah, that is going to be an issue that you may have to be dealing with down the road. And it'd be a good topic to discuss with some of the underwriters.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting to me, Chuck, is that we talked early on about a trend, apparently, that you've seen where new associations are having their governing documents drafted in such a way to pull the maintenance repair responsibilities for this exclusive use common area balcony back to the individual owner and not on the shoulders of the association as a way to somehow protect the association from liability. But are you recommending that?
No, I'm not recommending that at all. And I actually think it's a failure on the developers and the lawyers that are writing the governing documents for these associations in actually creating what's not a condominium project anymore. And so many of these documents are doing that. They're trying to create, single family home rules under condominium projects. And it's in complete difference between what the code calls a condominium and what the documents are now calling condominium associations. So we have a divergence, and we've had these problems over the years in dealing with these issues. And there's some great court cases on it where, the documents have said that the plumbing is even individual owners. And Dover Shores is an interesting case which said no. What Stanley Feltz had argued at the appellate court level, which actually said no. If the water's coming in through the common area to the building, then it's a common element and not a separate interest. So there have been some good court decisions out there helping associations and condominium associations specifically with the way these documents have been written.
That's encouraging.
So what about brand new buildings?
Yeah.
If you're built after 2025? Are they going to be required to do it starting 9 years from the time they were built?
Very, very good question. And there, as of 2025, new buildings have 6 years to do their inspection.
Even less.
So from their certificate of occupancy, they're required to do it within 6 years.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. Did either of you have anything else to add before we wrap it up?
Chuck, your knowledge about this bill is fantastic, and I certainly appreciate all the help on it. I've learned a lot on this podcast about the bill that I didn't know, and I think it will also be kind of a trigger for boards to look at the construction defect issue in general. I mean, now they have to, right? They have to address it.
You know, they really do. And that's a very, very good point, Tim. You know, that's one of the failures of this bill. But with my practice, it's certainly not a failure. With what this is actually going to do, I believe, is create more claims of construction defect because they have to do these inspections within 6 years of, you know, all new projects being built, obviously with 9 years from 2025. But what's interesting is, you know, that's exactly what this is going to do, because you're going to find, and decks are one of the hardest things to waterproof. They're one of the hardest things to structurally build. We find more problems with decks as construction defect lawyers than most other components in the building. So this is a great law because we're going to hopefully fix those decks before we create another problem like this, but it's also going to create more litigation, which nobody really wants. Except lawyers.
That was a question that I had. So you have seen other balcony situations of construction defect, not just the one up in Oakland.
You can ask any construction defect law firm out there or lawyer out there. This is an issue with most of our construction defect claims. Decks, windows, plumbing are usually the biggest issues we see.
And what's interesting about it is they're invisible, effectively, right to the eye. I mean, unless you open up the stucco and get up in there, how can you know that it's even occurring?
That's a great point, Tim. You know, sometimes you'll notice a spongy deck. Sometimes you'll see staining underneath it. But really, it's the trained eye of the architect or the structural engineer that's going to see it. And many times, you know, I will tell you, I had a case in Irvine, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where they had just repainted the building. And we're looking at it and saying, well, this looks beautiful. There's really no problems out here. Well, the association said, no, we were having problems before they came out and painted. They said they took care of it. We'd like you to test, you know, some of these decks and some of these stucco areas. We opened it up, and behind the beautiful paint, these decks were completely dry rotted out. It was a 320-unit condominium project. And out of 320 decks, I think we had to redo 270 of them. But you couldn't see it because they had just repainted. So once in a while, that does happen.
I guess going forward, and in summary, the first thing every association should do is start reserving. Do that immediately. And can the board just automatically add that? Do they need to get a vote from the membership to add that onto the reserves?
No, they'll just be able to add that reserve component on. Obviously, they're going to talk to the reserve company as well as their corporate counsel lawyer. But no, that's just a reserve item they can add on.
And then the second step after that, or concurrently, would be to contact an architect or an engineer that specializes in multifamily dwellings?
Correct.
And I guess just Google that?
I'm sorry, I think I'd mentioned before that I have seen some deck companies pop up, deck inspection companies. So those will probably encompass a one-stop shop where you'll be able to get the destructive testing crew, the architect and the structural engineer, and the statistician for extrapolation.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Chuck. How can our listeners reach you if they have more questions or want to learn more?
Our firm's website, fentongrat.com, or they can email me at cfenton@fentongrat.com. Be happy to answer any other questions and follow up with anybody. I really appreciate you guys having me on. Like I said, you know, we've all known each other a very long time. You know, Tim and I used to spend a lot of time in Los Angeles together, but I don't think we've seen each other for at least 6 or 7 years, and hope to see you and Ryan soon.
Thanks so much, Chuck. Well, that's our show for today. We'd like to thank Chuck and Tim for sharing their time and expertise with us. And as we end our episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for topics that you'd like to learn more about, you can email us at feedback at hoashow.org. feedback@hoashow.org. Join us next time on the HOA Show.
To share or subscribe to the HOA Show, visit us at hoashow.org. There, you'll be able to listen to other episodes, find helpful resources relating to HOAs, provide feedback, submit questions, and check out other great stuff. The HOA Show podcast has been made possible by the contributions of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, leaders in the community association industry. The views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests, do not constitute legal advice. For more information on how the topics in discussion apply to you, please consult with your own legal counsel.